Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I love having a full hour to explore one topic. It's an opportunity to understand something you've always had an interest in, and now you get a serious immersion in it. Or it's a chance to learn about something you haven't had much exposure to in the past. This hour, you'll have the opportunity to learn as much as you can about butterflies. Here to share his immense knowledge on the subject is Kent McFarland, a conservation biologist and the co-founder of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. Kent, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Great to be here talking about butterflies.
It's always great having you. Listeners, if you want to ask Kent a question about butterflies or share some that you've spotted recently, you can call us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kent, exactly how many different species of butterflies do we have in Vermont?
Well, it's pretty exciting. We have 115 species of butterflies now in Vermont. And the reason I say it's exciting because someone actually just discovered the 115th species back in the middle of June down in Shaftesbury. We had an observer find what's called a cloudless sulfur down there while she was doing a butterfly survey for a project we call eButterfly. And that has never been found in Vermont before. So we're still discovering new species every year.
Oh, that's fantastic. As a matter of fact, earlier this morning I told listeners we had 114, so we're amending that as we go. And, you know, how many different species are there globally of butterflies?
Well, butterflies are lumped with a group that scientists call Lepidoptera. It's an order that comprises moths and butterflies. And worldwide for moths and butterflies right now, there's about 150,000 moth and butterfly species in the world. But just like in Vermont, we're finding new species that are occupying our state. Scientists are finding new species that are new to science. And so that number just keeps changing. And out of that 150,000 moths and butterflies, just a fraction, about 20,000 of them are butterflies, sort of the day-flying marauders of that group.
What is the difference between a moth and a butterfly, Kent?
You know, it's here in the north, it's easy. When you get to the tropics, it's difficult because there's moths and butterflies that sort of act like each other. But here in the north, it's not just that butterflies fly in the daytime, because we also have moths that also like to fly in the daytime.
Yeah.
But the real easy way to tell a butterfly from a moth, at least here in the north, is if you look at their antenna. On a butterfly, the antenna of a butterfly always has a little knob at the end of it. It might be round, a knob. It might be sort of a hook. But the antenna ends in some kind of a knob. And butterflies, they either have a filament that has no knob on the end of it, or they have like a feathery structure for an antenna without a knob on it. So really, it's just looking at that antenna can quickly tell you whether it's a moth or a butterfly.
All right. And to be clear again, which one has the knob? The moth or the butterfly?
Butterflies have the knobs.
Moths do not. Okay. All right. Now, we have 115 different species of butterflies here in Vermont. How varied are the different butterflies that we have here?
Oh, my gosh. They're just like, you know, watching butterflies is like watching birds. It's everything from giant swallowtails. Literally, we have a swallowtail called the Eastern Giant Swallowtail, which is, I don't know, the size of my hand. It's the largest butterfly in North America. It looks like when it comes flying across a meadow, it looks like a bat flying at you. It's that big. So we have these giant swallowtails down to tiny little butterflies called skippers, yeah, which are just perplexing to most butterfly watchers sometimes, because they're sort of like, for bird watchers, when they look at little tiny warblers in the fall, these little butterflies are the same things. A lot of them are brown with very tiny markings on them. And so when you really get into butterfly watching, when you start identifying skippers, you know you've truly become like a real butterfly geek. They're very difficult.
All right. So, you know, we've heard about monarchs and some of the challenges they have. How healthy is our butterfly population here in the state?
Well, you know, it's hard to just lump all 115 species together and talk about whether they're healthy or not, because some of the species are doing really well, and some of them are not doing probably so well. We don't have as good of monitoring of butterflies as we do for, say, birds in the state, where we have things like Mountain Bird Watch, where we're monitoring birds up in the high elevations with citizen science. We've got these routes along roads that monitor birds every year. So we have really pretty good data every year for birds. But for butterflies, we don't really have that kind of monitoring. And so that's why we've started projects like eButterfly online for butterfly watchers to put their observations in, programs online like iNaturalist, where you can put your butterfly observations in. And then we have what's called the Vermont Butterfly Atlas, which we did 20 years ago now, which we're going to repeat pretty soon in the next couple of years so we can see long-term changes. So we don't have that kind of data that we do for birds or other wildlife as we do for butterflies. But, you know, we do know things like monarchs have not been doing well lately. Some of the skippers seem to not be doing as well this year, at least. But again, it's hard to say what populations are like year in, year out, just because we don't have the data yet. And that's where, you know, that's where recruiting folks that like to watch butterflies to help us collect that data comes in.
What challenges do butterflies face that you know, when you say the monarchs aren't doing as well, the skippers, you know, what is it that is taking its toll on them?
Well, this year, you probably noticed the weather this year has been kind of wild. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a really dry spring to start off with, you know, and that's tough on butterflies when there's a dry spring like that. And then we go into this really wet July. I mean, I don't know where you are, but here down where I live in Woodstock, this year we're already double the rainfall average for July. And butterflies are little solar-powered organisms. They don't like all that rain necessarily. They need sunny days to be flying about. So observing butterflies for me down here right now for this month has been real difficult just because of the weather. And I think it's probably difficult on their life history too. They really, like I said, need that sunlight to power their muscles so they can fly around and mate and get food. So weird weather is really difficult on butterflies. Long-term changes in climate is another thing that's been difficult for some butterflies, but probably benefits others. So for example, well, the giant swallowtail I just talked about, that mm-hmm. butterfly actually wasn't discovered in Vermont until 2010. And since then, it has become a regular resident in Vermont and found throughout much of the state, actually. And we think that's probably because our winters have warmed up, and now they can survive the winters here when they overwinter.
Wow. And so
climate change has some good effects for some butterflies, and some others, it's probably not going to be that great for them. It just depends on what your life history trait is. And then, you know, honestly, for a lot of insects, like we like to say, it's death by a thousand cuts. It's, you know, you got climate change and the weird weather, which is also part climate change, but then you have pesticides and insecticides. You've got land use changes. You've got all kinds of things like that that just can, you know, add up to really affecting populations.
Yeah. Let's go to Randolph and Bobby, who's on the phone with us now. Hi, Bobby. Go right ahead.
I was wondering if you had a species that was all white in yours. I spotted an all white one the other day. It was probably one wingspan from body to end of the wing, and then the wing itself is like 2 inches.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, absolutely. There's three species of butterflies that could be, depending on some fine details. So if it's absolutely completely white butterfly with no markings on it right now, it's a butterfly called the mustard white. And that's a butterfly that actually likes the forest more than fields and open areas, but it will fly in open areas too. And it's just right now, it's just completely white. Butterfly, but there's one that looks a lot like it, which we're all probably pretty familiar with in our gardens, which are cabbage whites. And they're white, but they usually have a dark dot on their wing, a dot or two on their upper wing, and maybe even a little black on the tip of their wing. And we're all familiar with those because the caterpillars are often on some of the plants in our gardens that drive us crazy. So that species mustard white is native, and the cabbage white was introduced from Europe accidentally. So those are two right now that are very white butterflies that you might see flying around.
All right, Bobby, thanks for that call. We have Stephen joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I have a question about butterflies, and I understand that some butterflies, like the tiger swallowtail, have eyes in rather strange places. And I have this book, Buzz, Sting, Bite, by Annie Sverdov-Tagesson. And I don't want to mention where those eyes are, but I just wanted to see if there was a comment on where, you know, about where butterflies have eyes.
All right. Kent, when I look into the eyes of a butterfly, especially the tiger swallowtail, where am I looking?
Yeah, I'm not really sure what that refers to, but I'm not sure I know exactly where these other weird eyes are. But yeah, the big eyes in the front that are obvious have lots of lenses on them, and butterflies can see in really strange light compared to us. So they see all kinds of UV light and different colors. So to them, flowers look a lot different, and even male colors of butterflies to females look a lot different to their eyes because they can see such a wider range of light than we can into the UV spectrum. I'm not sure where these hidden eyes are. I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, Stephen, do you want to share where the...
Well, they at least according to this book, they have eyes on the end of their penis.
Oh, wow. That would be interesting.
Wow. Yeah, that's another crazy fact about butterflies to put away there again. The other cool thing about it is you know, having strange sensory places and having sensory things in strange places is the way they taste, which is also kind of trips me out. They can taste with their feet. So if you ever watch, for example, a monarch laying eggs on common milkweed, they will land on the milkweed and they prick the milkweed. They prick the plants with their feet. And there are chemoreceptors on there that they're tasting what the chemistry is of the plant and deciding, you know, is this plant going to be good enough for me to put my eggs on or not? Is it the right plant? So tasting with your feet is another crazy thing for butterflies.
Wow, if I ever stomp grapes, I hope I can taste through my feet. That would be pretty exciting. Kent, what is it that you love so much about butterflies?
You know, when you read your entry into this part of the show, it really rang true with me. They're these delicate, beautiful, colorful winged creatures that just seem to flutter around and have, honestly, they feel like they have freedom or no care in the world. And they're only out. The other big thing is they're really only out on sunny, nice days. And I often joke with some of the students now. I'm like, if you're going to pick a study species, maybe you should pick butterflies because it's always going to be field work on beautiful, sunny days, and you can sleep in. I actually started out most of my research as an ornithologist, so I'm trained to do bird studies, and I think birds are elegant and beautiful too, but somehow I just got hooked on these beautiful, what I like to call winged wildflowers, these colorful butterflies just zooming around the meadows. It's just something that just, you know, tugged at my heart when I see them flying around.
Yeah, I totally get that. So let's talk about the general habitat of butterflies. You know, where do they hang out? Where do they sleep? Where do they shelter, you know, on those rainy days that they don't want to go fluttering about?
You know, that's a good question. And on rainy days, especially this month with all the rain we've had, I've often gotten frustrated and started to go outside and try to see if I can stir up a butterfly. you know, I go to these places, a meadow right above my house here, where I can find, you know, plenty of butterflies on a sunny day like today flying around. And I go there on a cloudy or rainy day, and I can't find a single butterfly. And so I've gone out before and tried to find out where are they hanging out on these bad days. And I think it really is important for them to hang out somewhere where birds aren't going to find them, where mice aren't going to find them, where some kind of predator isn't going to find them. So they're trying to find places that are very difficult to find too. And a lot of them, you know, they're all bright and flashy, but when they close their wings, also, you'll notice that a lot of them are pretty well camouflaged.
Right.
So if they have their wings closed and they're not moving, they're tough to see. So I've looked through the grass. I've looked on tree trunks. And very rarely do I find a butterfly hanging out on a cloudy or rainy day. It's amazing how they just sort of can just disappear and hide. So, you know, it's kind of a mystery where they're hanging out. But when I do find them, they're often buried in the grass somewhere. I've seen them on tree trunks or in the crack of a tree hiding on those rainy days. So, you know, it's really, I won't say it's almost a waste of a time trying to find them on a rainy, cloudy day, because it's just, it's unbelievably frustrating.
They are wily.
But for habitats on a sunny day to look for them, I mean, really, just like birds, they're in, you can think of any habitat in Vermont, and there's some kind of butterfly that inhabits it, even in the forests. There's a butterfly called the West Virginia white. It's another one of those, the earlier caller asked about white butterflies. It's another one of those almost pure white butterflies. But the reason I didn't mention that one is the West Virginia white only flies in the springtime from April through May. That's it. It's done. Yeah. And it only flies in the forest, and it needs rich hardwood forests. So hardwood forests that have a beautiful wildflower for an understory in the spring is a place you'll find West Virginia whites. And once the trees leaf out over top of it, and the plants that it likes under the understory go back into dormancy because of the shade, this butterfly also goes into dormancy until next year. And so here you think of butterflies being all out in the open in gardens and meadows, but here's a butterfly that absolutely lives only in our hardwood forests. So, you know, literally you can find butterflies in any habitat. Another one I really love is looking for butterflies in bogs. Those crazy wetlands that sort of quake under your feet. There's some amazing butterflies you can find in there, in bogs too, that are only there. So really, anywhere you go at the right time of year, on a nice day, you're going to run into some kind of butterfly.
I want to be a West Virginia white. Work for 2 months and then take the next 10 months off. All right, back to the phones. Here's Norm in Bristol. Hi, Norm. Go right ahead.
Hi, I have an interesting story to relate to everybody. I was out working in my yard about 2 years ago, splitting wood, and it was a warm day, and I had a few. I was encouraging monarchs to land on my milkweeds. Mm-hmm. I've been growing milkweed now in a small spot.
Well done.
So anyways, I wanted to relate this story. I was taking a break, and I was seeing this monarch flying around me. So I had little beads of sweat on my hand, so I put it out in front of it, and it landed on my hand. So I brought it over to a goldenrod because I had to get back to splitting, and then, you know, sort of coaxed it onto the top of the goldenrod. And then as I was walking back, it was flying around me again, so I put my other hand out with a little beads of sweat on it, and it landed on that.
Hmm.
So then I coaxed that back onto the goldenrod, and then I was walking away, and it's flying around. It came over, and it landed on my cheek.
Wow.
And then, as I was walking away again, it flew off, and I stopped, and it came over and landed on my earlobe.
Incredible, Norm.
Yeah, it was just like it was talking to me, you know, through my ear, you know, and it was so cool. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever had happen to me.
Oh, I love that story. Thanks for that. Do we have that kind of interaction a lot, Kent, between butterflies and humans?
You know, I love that story because it happens to me occasionally when I'm out surveying butterflies on a hot day, because if you get a little sweat going, not a running sweat, but like he said, beads of sweat, mm-hmm. that salt is a real attractant for butterflies. You'll notice butterflies on dirt roads sometimes, around wet puddles. It's actually called puddling. And the butterflies like to land on those wet areas, including our wet skin, and lap up with their long tongue. They like to lap up those salts and minerals from the mud or from our sweat. And it's a way for them to get energy. You often see in the springtime, speaking of tiger swallowtails, you can find on the dirt roads masses of tiger swallowtails sometimes around a certain spot on the dirt road where you know there must be a good mineral there that they're lapping up. So, yeah, this is a phenomenon that can actually happen, you know, pretty often, actually, where they just become our little friend and love to get some of our sweat.
Oh, man, I love that story. Norton, thanks for sharing that. Conservation biologist Kent McFarland of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies is my guest this hour as we learn all about Vermont's butterflies. Listeners, to get in the queue to ask Kent a question about butterflies, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And you can always email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. We've got CBS News update coming up next, then we'll be back with Kent for the rest of the hour. And coming up at 1 o'clock today on WDEV, we've got the monster size version of The Getaway with Greg Hooker going straight through to 4 o'clock. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Twice I've had the opportunity to experience the Butterflies Go Free exhibit at the Montreal Botanical Garden. Everyone who visits is captivated and mesmerized as butterflies sail by and gently land on a leaf or near a waterfall. There's a quiet calmness that pervades the space. This morning, we're getting a better understanding of butterflies from the co-founder of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, Kent McFarland. Listeners, you can join in. Give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Back to the phones we go. We got Phil calling in from Florida. Hi, Phil. Go right ahead.
Well, good morning, guys. I'm listening to your show every day down here in Florida, and today's subject is excellent, so I wanted to chime in a little bit.
Sure.
Down here in Florida, I've lived in Vermont my first 74 years. Now I'm in a new life. But we went to a place called Butterfly World in Coconut Creek, Florida, mm-hmm. in early 2020, just before COVID. It's right near Tampa. I mean, right near right near Fort Lauderdale. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
But it was absolutely amazing, the different kinds of butterflies. And we walked into this giant screen house, and the butterflies would literally land on us, and they would be so many of them, they'd be almost bumping into each other. It was just spectacular.
Yeah.
And one thing I remember was they had a like a dish, and they had a banana, a very ripe banana cut lengthwise, and the bananas would feed on that.
Yeah, Phil, thanks for that. Let's talk about Kent. You know, you talked about the salt, but don't butterflies also love things that are sweet, like with nectar and things like that?
Yeah, most butterflies, well, I guess all butterflies definitely feed on nectar from flowers. Mm-hmm. But you can also, in your garden, if you have a sunny day, you can actually put fruit out like that, like a rotting banana that's gone past and you're not going to eat, or any kind of fruit. You can put it out on a dish near your, if you have a little butterfly garden or a little garden, and you'll get some of our what are called brushfoot butterflies, which includes monarchs and other species in that group. You'll get those that'll come in sometimes and start feeding on that fruit, just like they do inside some of those butterfly captivity areas too. So you can actually do the same thing right outside in your garden. It says, you know, there's not as many butterflies around in captivity that'll come like that. But after a while, especially earlier in the summer, you'll get some that'll come onto that banana and start licking at it if you watch it carefully.
Well, Kent, let's talk about, you talked about a butterfly garden. You know, what are plants that we can grow that are really helpful, that will attract butterflies and be helpful to butterflies?
Yeah, well, the caller earlier about the monarch nailed it when he talked about monarchs, and he said, you know, that he keeps some of the common milkweed around for monarchs. So that's a big one, and everyone knows about that. I mean, I know milkweed sometimes can be a little bit weedy and get into your garden and be a problem, but if you can keep as much of that around as possible, you'll definitely have monarch eggs on it most years. I just went out, you know, I have a tiny little patch of land here. I live on a quarter of an acre, and I try to do as little as mowing as possible, which is always a battle with my wife, who likes the grass, but that's all right. And but I have a little tiny area that I call a pollinator garden, which to most people kind of looks a little bit weedy, but it's got a lot of flowers in it that I let grow up, including milkweed. And I try to put in stuff in there that flowers year round, you know, at different times of year. So I have New England aster in there for later in the fall, when it looks beautiful when it blooms, and butterflies absolutely love the nectar on it. I've got some blueberry plants around the edges for earlier in the year. A big one are willow trees, like pussy willow, if you have those on the edges. Early in the season, those are really important for bees and butterflies to nectar on. And one of them that actually doesn't usually grow here but grows in southern Vermont, I have, which I really like, is button bush, which is this little bush that has these globe-round flowers on it. It's just about to flower right now in my garden. And boy, the butterflies just love the nectar on that. So any of these native plants that are flowering plants that you can have in your garden are just really great for a variety of things like bees and butterflies. And there's some great farms around that horticultural areas around that produce native plants that you can use too. So if you look around your area, you'll find some of the farms that are selling plants and stuff that are native plants for butterfly gardens. You just have to look around carefully and try to buy stuff that's native and has no pesticides involved in it either. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about what the butterflies do in the winter, because as I understand it, don't the monarchs, you know, trek all the way to Mexico, but you also talked about butterflies overwintering in Vermont. So do some migrate, some not? What goes on?
Well, I love to tell everyone, in the depths of winter, on that February day when you're sick of it being dark at 4:15 and there's 3 feet of snow out your window, just remember, there's a butterfly within a stone's throw away from you sitting out there somewhere. And that makes me smile a little bit.
Wow.
So, yeah, the monarchs and some other species, they will migrate and take off. And I can talk about the monarchs in a second about their migration.
Okay.
So there are other species that will migrate, too, and leave here. Not quite as spectacular as monarchs. They just sort of flutter down as far as they need to and lay eggs further south. But then there's the butterflies that overwinter here. And believe it or not, some of them overwinter as adults. And so things like the morning cloak butterfly, which is often a butterfly that people first see in the spring. It's a dark-colored butterfly, maybe the size of a silver dollar or a little bit bigger, and it has a sort of a yellow fringe around it, and it's called the morning cloak. And you'll find it early in the spring, as early as sometimes late April, but definitely early May. And it'll be sucking at some sap that's dripping somewhere, trying to get some energy after it hung inside maybe a crack in a rock or a hollow log. It hung inside that as an adult the whole winter, just waiting for spring to come. And what they do is they get rid of sort of all the moisture that's inside their body. They expel it, and they replace it with basically the same kind of stuff that you have in your car, antifreeze. And they can withstand something like minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit before it kills them. So I don't know about you, if it ever gets to be minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit here in Vermont, it might be one thing that might make me leave Vermont, but that would be it.
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. All right, and you're going to tell us about the monarchs then. Oh, I love this.
Well, yeah, so the monarch, everyone knows, I think most people know the monarch. The generation right now that we're seeing on our plants, the eggs and the caterpillars, they're going to grow up pretty soon in the next couple of weeks and become adults. And that's the generation that I like to call the super monarch. It's going to take off starting right now, but mostly in August and September. that group is going to take off and head to Mexico, some, you know, 3,000-4,000 miles to Mexico.
Tequila.
And yeah, exactly. What a smart butterfly. Go for a vacation.
That's right.
So it's going to basically glide its whole way to Mexico on winds. Just like our hawks do when they take off, like broad-winged hawks.
Yeah.
They're not really going to flap there. They're just going to glide and use very little energy to get there. And the cool thing about it is most of the birds that we have here right now that are going to migrate, say, to Central America, the Caribbean, and the Amazon, they fatten up and get super fat before they take off and fly, and they burn that fat to fly to wherever they're going. Right. Monarchs, on the other hand, are the lightest probably they're ever going to be when they're here in Vermont. And they get fatter and fatter as they get closer and closer to Mexico. And when they get into the mountains of Mexico where they're going to overwinter in these special high-elevation forests, they're the fattest they're ever going to be, hopefully. And the way they do that is, like I said, is they're going to glide and they're going to nectar on plants, hopefully, the whole way down there. So they're going to stop and eat and store up fat in their belly. And they need that fat so that when they get in the mountains of Mexico and they hang in these fir trees that are very similar to the fir trees on the high elevations of the Green Mountains, they hang in there all winter long. They have this fat to slowly burn and survive the whole winter before they fly back to the Gulf Coast of Mexico, of the United States in March. Hmm. So the Vermont monarch is taken off soon, is going to go the whole way to Mexico, overwinter there in the mountains, then in the spring fly to the Gulf Coast, say, of Texas, mate, lay eggs, and probably die there. A generation is raised in the south end, and then it flies further north to where there's more milkweed coming out in the springtime. And then that generation flies a little bit further north and arrives in Vermont. And they'll arrive here, say, earliest is the end of May, but most of them are arriving in sometime in June here. Mm-hmm. And then we have one or two generations, probably two generations, that are here in Vermont. And resulting in the last generation that we have right now that once again flies back. So it takes 4 or 5 generations in 1 year's time to go from Mexico to Vermont and back to Mexico, which is amazing.
Yeah.
So the funny thing is the monarchs you see flying around right now, the adults, were probably born here in Vermont, and they're going to die here in Vermont. They're producing the super monarch generation that's going to go to Mexico.
Yeah.
So I always like to say, don't tell them. They're never going to get to go to Mexico. They're just pure monarchs. Don't tell them the secret, you know?
Kent, starting tomorrow, you've got a really big butterfly event, the Monarch Blitz, going on through August 1st. So what happens during this week?
Yeah, well, Rick, earlier you mentioned going up to Montreal and seeing the butterflies at the Botanical Garden. Mm. And luckily, that's the insectarium in Montreal is going to reopen in December with even bigger indoor butterfly display. And I bring them up because we've teamed up with them for a project called Mission Monarch. It's mission-monarch.org. And basically what we're trying to do is for 10 days starting tomorrow is to have everybody across Vermont and beyond go out and do 4 easy steps. Find milkweed. Look at each milkweed plant and find the eggs and the caterpillars on them and count them. Write down your observations on a piece of paper, and then go to missionmonarch.org and sign up and put your data from what you've counted into the system on Mission Monarch. It's so easy. You can take 5 minutes in your backyard and count 5 plants if you want, or you can go to a big field and count 100 if you want. We've made it so that anybody from the age of 8 to 80 can do this without problem, so we can get as many counts as we can across Vermont and beyond to find out what this last generation, the generation that's going to go to Mexico, find out how well they're doing every year. And it's a way for us to monitor monarch populations across Vermont.
Oh, I love it. Mission-monarch.org is where you can go to find out all about it. And it starts tomorrow, goes through August 1st, and it's massively helpful. Kent, one more thing about, you know, we talked about what we can grow in butterfly gardens. What are things we should avoid doing to protect the health of our butterflies here in Vermont?
Well, a couple of things. One is mowing, and, you know, we're all guilty of probably mowing too much, maybe getting the weed whacker out and going at it a little bit too hard. I just sometimes I can't resist too, but like leaving some messy areas where flowers come up and it looks a little weedy is often great for all pollinators, not just butterflies. So that's one thing that's pretty easy to do, but hard mentally for us to do.
All right.
The other thing is being really careful about what kind of pesticides you're using, if you're using any pesticides at all. There's a few pesticides that are really tough on pollinators, like butterflies and bees. It's a class of insecticides called neonicotinoids, which were kind of invented in the 1990s. And they're in a lot of household garden sprays, and you wouldn't know it unless you looked carefully. And they're also put into seeds, and also some nurseries put it on plants, and you wouldn't know it when you buy it unless you ask about it or you go to a really good nursery that you can tell by their label. Mm-hmm. And it's a systemic, so it's in the plant for a while, which means it's in the plant's nectar, and then the butterfly sucks it up in the nectar, or the bees suck it up in there, and they're really sensitive to that pesticide. I mean, it's a great pesticide to keep plants looking good because it's a broad spectrum pesticide that kills a lot of insects, but unfortunately, it's even in small doses, it's really rugged for a lot of our pollinators. So being careful about what you have in your garden in that respect is really important.
Do we have invasive butterflies that we have to worry about in the way we do with invasive species of insects like the hemlock woolly adelgid or that ilk?
You know, we have introduced butterfly species, but I don't think any of them are, I would call, invasive. So they're introduced non-natives, but they're not like that. They're not taking over and competing with other things as far as we know so far.
Mm-hmm.
There is one that you'll see a lot of in June in hayfields called the European skipper. It's a little tiny orange skipper, and sometimes you'll go into hayfields, and there can be thousands of them in these hayfields. It was accidentally introduced from Europe, probably on hay that came into, I think it came into Canada originally, accidentally, and just has spread across North America. So, I mean, that would be one I would think that might possibly compete with other things, but hay fields aren't super great for butterflies in general. So, and it feeds on timothy grass, and which a lot of other species don't. So I don't think it's competing with other things. And then there's one of the, well, before this year with the cloudless sulfur, the last newest butterfly was last year called the common blue, which is a beautiful blue butterfly that was accidentally introduced around the airport in Montreal. And now last September was just found in Alberg's Dune State Park, and then somebody found some in St. Albans. So they're spreading out a little bit more, and they've arrived in Vermont. But that species seems to be one that likes to be around garden plants a lot more and not necessarily competing with our native species. So far, I don't think there are any introduced species that I would call invasive or problematic quite yet.
I'm not going to give you a lot of time, about a minute and a half left, but I do want to hop over to the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Tell us a little bit about these alpine butterflies that live there.
There's some special butterflies in the Presidential Range above treeline on Mount Washington. There's one called the Judd Arctic. Called the White Mountain Arctic. The Judd Arctic is one that lives in bogs here. The White Mountain Arctic, it only lives on the top of Mount Washington, and its closest relative would be clear up probably in the Gaspé Peninsula above treeline, pretty far away. So it got trapped up there after the glaciers left, and, you know, as the tundra receded to the north, it's only found in that alpine zone is only found up high, so its host plant is only there, and so it's stuck on the Presidential Range. And then there's the White Mountain Fritillary, which is this tiny, beautiful orange butterfly. Same thing. It's only found on top of Mount Washington. It flies in August and September. Beautiful butterfly. There may be only, I don't know, maybe 1,000 of them a year flying up there. Mm. And again, its closest relative is going to be clear up in the Arctic or maybe in the Gaspé Peninsula up in Quebec. So they're trapped on this. They're like on this little island of habitat. And they've been stuck there for 8,000-9,000 years since the glaciers receded. They've been stuck on top of these islands on this, of these mountain islands. So it's a fun trip to go up there on the road and check them out if you want to sometime.
Nature. Kent McFarland is a conservation biologist and the co-founder of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. The website is vtecostudies.org. And don't forget also mission-monarch.org for that big monarch blitz. Kent, always fascinating having you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Rick. It's been great.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break and for the top of the hour news, then we'll be back to discuss why Vermont has seen such a rise in traffic fatalities. And the Sox return to Fenway tonight to open a four-game series against the Yankees. Our coverage begins at 6:10, first pitch 7:10 tonight. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We were able to work from home. We were traveling to less places. So what in the heck were we doing on Vermont's roadways during the pandemic? Sadly, not driving with the same care and consideration Vermonters usually do. Even with far less traffic, the number of fatalities on our roadways remained high. It's time to discuss the reasons and what we as drivers need to do to make sure that our roadways are safe. Joining us to discuss these topics is Agency of Transportation Operations and Safety Bureau Analyst Mandy White. Mandy, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning.
Morning. Lieutenant Tara Thomas is the Safety Program Executive Officer for the Vermont State Police. Lieutenant Thomas, thank you for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity. Good morning.
You're welcome. Good morning. And Bill Jenkins is the Law Enforcement Liaison for the State Highway Safety Office. Bill, thank you for being here as well.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, listeners, if you've got questions or comments about what you've been seeing on our roadways, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bill, before we get into the data, we're all aware of the Agency of Transportation and the Vermont State Police, but I'd like you to tell us about the role of the State Highway Safety Office.
Okay. Well, the role of State Highway Safety Office is to, you know, promote safety on the roadways and highways of Vermont. So our mission is to try to achieve progress towards zero deaths by reducing the number of crashes and injuries and fatalities on Vermont's roads. You know, we do that focusing really on the what they call the four E's, which is enforcement, or we assist law enforcement agencies with enforcement, educating the public, engineering improvements to the roadways, and assisting with or trying to assist with emergency service response.
Gotcha. The four E's: enforcement, education, engineering, and emergency assistance. Now, Mandy, we're hearing that traffic fatalities are up in Vermont. What does the data from 2020 and currently in 2021 show?
So the fatalities for 2021 are up a little bit from 2020. We have about 34 currently this year fatalities as opposed to 27 at this time last year. If we compare it back to 2019, we had 14 at this time. So we're definitely seeing an increase in the fatalities for this year.
And do we know what 2020 showed?
27 as of this year. If you want to look at the final number for 2020, we had 61 fatalities.
And how does that compare to an average year in Vermont?
So 2020 technically was an average year. We see about 60 to 65 fatalities a year in Vermont.
And that was with less people driving, correct?
Correct. We had about an 18% decrease on our roads for vehicles traveled.
Lieutenant Thomas, when you look at that kind of data, what is the message that you and the Vermont State Police want to send to drivers?
I believe our message is that we just want people to take the privilege of operating a motor vehicle seriously. We all see firsthand the results when someone doesn't. And I do strongly believe that if we just work together, we all really can make our roads safer.
And Bill Jenkins, from your office's perspective, the State Highway Safety Office, again, you know, what is it that you want to let people know after looking at that data, which can't be encouraging?
No, unfortunately, it's not encouraging. You know, I say it all the time, it's really the basics. It's not rocket science. It's what we all know, but unfortunately, it can be difficult to get the message out and to get people to follow some of the rules. And, you know, that's not driving impaired. It's wearing your seatbelt, which is, you know, regardless of the law, is quite frankly the cheapest insurance that you can get. It's not speeding, and because obviously as the speed goes up, the chance for injury goes up as well. And it's just paying attention to what you're doing. You know, we focus a lot on the phones, you know, people using the phones, mm-hmm. but it's everything. It's not just the phones. It's people daydreaming or whatever else and just not keeping their focus on the roadways.
Boy, your point about the seatbelt is certainly one that hits home with me. I've had just a few accidents in my life, but when I have had them and you hit a stationary object, it's almost like a hand just takes you and pushes you right back in your seat, keeps you in that space, that room to live, that they call it, and keeps you from hurtling forward. So if you don't wear a seatbelt, I'm going to preach about that one because I felt it several times in my life, and it really is a lifesaver. Let's go to the phones. We've got Fred calling. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Good
morning.
Let's see here. My question is, these new electric cars, I get the feeling they're going to be problematic because just the run-of-the-mill electric car is probably going to be able to accelerate from 0 to 60 in under 4 seconds. I think that could end up being a problem. What do you think as far as the state police are concerned?
All right, Lieutenant Thomas, what do you think?
It was a little difficult to hear, but I think he was referencing electric cars and the speed that they can go.
And accelerate quickly.
Accelerate, yeah. Whether it's electric or gas, the speed is clearly a concern for law enforcement and our highway safety partners. It's just, you know, I'm sure it's tempting when you have those vehicles, but the result can be, devastating. So we just kind of ask that people just be, revert right back to Bill's point, just be responsible, speed, distraction, impairment, and using your seatbelt. Those are all things that do result in people driving safely. And just speaking to the point of the seatbelt, we really do emphasize, sadly, when someone doesn't wear their seatbelt. But there's thousands and thousands of cases out there when the seatbelt saves a life that doesn't necessarily get advertised like it does when we have a fatal that occurs on our roadways. So we need to draw attention to the fact that there's so many people that walk away from crashes with either zero to little injury because they're wearing their seatbelts. And it's unfortunate the only ones that really kind of get the attention of the media are the ones when it takes a life when someone doesn't wear a seatbelt. So there's more success stories out there for seatbelt use than there are for those that don't.
I can remember when we dialed back the national speed limit to 55 miles an hour on all our interstates when we had the gas crisis. I sure hope, you know, we don't have to do that again in the face of rising traffic fatalities. It was almost like the wearing of the mask when driving. But, we have been given the freedom to go faster to, 65-mile speed limits in most areas on interstates. And I think we're used to that. We would prefer not to have that. So, again, another call for more safety. Bill, we're looking at the data, of Vermont's traffic fatality numbers. How do they tend to compare to the rest of the country?
Well, you know, obviously each state is an individual, problem or state or has their individual stats. But what I can tell you is that when we talk to our partners from around the country and read the documents or bulletins that come out, is that it's definitely a nationwide problem right now, despite vehicle miles traveled down pretty much throughout the entire country. Fatals went up last year nationally 7.2%. So in 2019, there were just over 36,000 fatalities nationwide. And last year in 2020, there were 38,680. And NHTSA, who provides funding for us, they break the country down into regions. And New England, except for Connecticut was in the region two, but New England is region one, and all of New England was up 9% for fatalities.
Wow.
So it's not just a Vermont problem. It's a nationwide problem. It's a regional problem. And, why did fatalities go up even though vehicle miles traveled were down?
Yeah.
That's still an open question. We're really not sure yet.
Mandy, what do we know about the causes of the traffic fatalities in Vermont?
For 2021, we're seeing 72% of our fatalities are unbelted. We've had a lot of unbelted, ejected occupants. Speed, so far, what we know of the 31 fatal crashes this year, 29% of them are speed-related. From what we know so far for the 31 crashes, 32% of them are impaired. So those are pretty high numbers.
Yeah.
Definitely, those are the big three that we tend to track pretty closely.
Let's go to Bristol next and talk to Fred. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me. Question for all the guests. I wonder if it's perceived that the roads are safer because there's less cars on the road. Are people more likely to take more chances? Drive faster, drive drunk, that kind of thing. And maybe that's leading to the rise in crashes or fatalities. That's my question.
Yeah, great question, Fred. Let's put it to Bill first. Bill Jenkins, what do you think about that?
That is definitely one of the theories or the ideas. He kind of hit the nail on the head that with the less traffic here in Vermont and nationwide, the roads are more open, people drive faster. You know, as much as we all hate traffic, it slows us down just because, you know, we have no choice.
Right.
So you get a nice open interstate, you go faster. And maybe since there's less people on the road, they take other chances as well as far as drinking. And then when people are impaired, they can forget to wear their seatbelt as well.
Mandy, what do you think about what Fred had to say about, it seems counterintuitive, right, that here we are, we have less people driving, and we should see, a similar drop in the number of traffic fatalities, but we're not seeing that.
Yeah, we certainly would have expected that. A lot of states were expecting it, and then we didn't see that in the data at all. I agree with Fred. I think that a lot of people felt with the open road, there was that ability to be a little more risky with their behavior. And as traffic has come back slowly from that pandemic level, we're still seeing the risky behavior. I think there's been a shift and people are with more people on the roads now than there were. During the pandemic or during the stay-at-home order, people are still being risky, and we're seeing that in our data now.
All right, Fred, you definitely have a career in traffic safety analysis. Heading to Randolph next, and Doug. Hi, Randolph. Doug, go right ahead.
One thing is, just think about how much money we spend to keep from hurting ourselves.
Yeah.
As in highway safety things, the car safety, all that stuff. But anyway, the thing I see is people just don't respect each other anymore. The road rage is unbelievable. And at the commuter traffic, I have a scanner, so I listen to it. In the afternoon, it all picks right up, which takes up the police time.
Yep.
because they don't can't get along with each other.
Yeah. Doug, excellent points, and I'll put that to Lieutenant Thomas. You know, what are you seeing out there on the roadways as far as drivers respecting each other, the road rage that can exist, and the resulting, you know, accidents that happen because of it?
I believe a common denominator with road rage is that people just aren't leaving themselves enough time to get to their destination, and then they feel hurried, they feel rushed, they start to get impatient. You know, they're hitting the red lights and they don't want to hit the red lights and the stop signs. So their threshold for tolerance, it just is in the negative to begin with. And then the minute someone just isn't kind of complying with their goal to get to work faster is when they start to just get angry. So if people just step back and allow themselves enough time, you know, I have a really strong team of subject matter experts in regards to traffic safety, and some, you know, include traffic crash reconstruction experts, and it takes a significant amount of speed and a significant amount of time to make up any sort of difference. So if you're running 10 minutes late to work, you driving in way excess of the speed limit is not going to get you there any faster than you actually think it is. So just having some patience and some time is definitely safer.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Same thing in the winter. We think that, you know, when there's snow, we still have to go the same speed. But if you dial it back and drive safely, it's only going to be a matter of a few minutes in your commute. But you're going to arrive safely. Bill, it's construction season, so how important is it for drivers to realize what road crews are doing and to obey construction zone speed limits?
Well, it's extremely important. You know, and I tell people, I try to get people to put yourself in their shoes. You're standing out there pretty much unprotected other than some cones, and cars are going by at, you know, 70 miles an hour when they're speeding. So they should be slowing down to the reduced posted speed limit for the construction zone. You know, and it only, like Lieutenant Thomas just said, I mean, how much time are you going to save by going through that construction zone at 10 miles an hour over the speed limit? It's insignificant, especially when compared to the danger you're putting those people in. So, you know, be courteous, just slow down for that short amount of time and give them the space that they need.
Exactly. Mandy White, another thing we should consider is what, you know, are the times of day, the weather conditions, when we do see most of the traffic accidents?
They are spread out all over the times of the day, but I know we see a lot more crashes during rush hour time. So, early, you know, in the morning when people are trying to get to work, or when in the afternoon when they're trying to get home.
Mm-hmm.
That's typical for us to see, and I think a lot of states see the same issues.
So, as Lieutenant Thomas said, leave a little more time so you're not, you know, trying to beat everybody on the highway.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Lieutenant Thomas, I know it's the middle of the summer, but we have a lot of new Vermonters who have moved here during the pandemic. I'm always reminded of the V-Trans commercials about the importance of winter tires. Can you talk just about that so people can plan ahead for winter, and also just a little bit on winter driving cautions?
Certainly. Well, preparation is key. I'm a native to Vermont, and there's still some winters that kind of surprise me. And we don't generally get in trouble when we have the advertised snowstorms coming. It's the little dustings of snow that just hit that pavement that people underestimate the dangers of that. So if people can just prepare and have proper tires on with good treads and reduce their speed and kind of respect the roadways and these storms that the New England states can bring, they're definitely going to be in better shape. I don't know what the pandemic is bringing for, has brought for production with tires. So I would probably, I don't think it's too careless to start planning for at least ordering those sooner than later, because Mother Nature tends to strike when we least expect it, and who knows what 2021 winter will bring.
Yeah, and those tires, it's not just the tread and the grip on snow and ice, but you should remember that the rubber compound is different in a winter tire that helps you, I think it's at a, like from 40 degrees and lower. as far as the grip that it does provide on a highway or on a road surface. So keep that in mind, listeners, as we head into winter, which, you know, comes quicker, more quickly here than in other places. Bill, distracted driving is something we should hit while we just have a couple minutes left. Is this still a problem in Vermont, and, you know, how do we combat it?
Well, it's definitely a problem in Vermont and nationwide. So I just like to remind people that distracted driving is basically any activity that diverts your attention from the important task of driving. So that's, you know, talking or texting on the phone or to a passenger. It can be eating or drinking. Can be, you know, talking to your kids in the back seat, looking at your kids in the back seat, you know, trying to restrain your dog. You know, who knows? It can be all kinds of things.
Changing CD is my number
exactly.
One. Yep.
And so just real quick, you know, there's basically four types of distraction, visual, audio, manual, and cognitive. You know, and if you think about it, your phone hits all four of them at once. You can be looking at it, listening to it, manipulating it with your hands, and obviously it takes your mind off what you're doing. So that's why I think it's so important to put the phone down.
And in the time it takes to do one of those things, I mean, how far are we traveling in terms of distance?
Well, stats say that, you know, on average, a text takes about 5 seconds. And if you look down at your phone for 5 seconds, you go about, if you're going 55 miles per hour, you go about the length of a football field.
Wow. A lot can happen in those 5 seconds. That is Bill Jenkins. He's the law enforcement liaison for the State Highway Safety Office. We've also spoken with Mandy White, an analyst for the Agency of Transportation Operations and Safety Bureau, and Lieutenant Tara Thomas, the Safety Program Executive Officer for the Vermont State Police. I want to thank you all for being here and really delivering that important message. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to be back to meet Lauren Randall, who is currently apprenticing as a tattoo artist. And coming up today at 11 o'clock on WDEV, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Now, let's talk tats. Not all of us have them, but I'm pretty sure all of us have contemplated getting one, even if it was something hidden and demure. This morning, we're going to learn about the other side of the equation. We're about to meet a woman who is an apprentice learning the trade of tattooing. Lauren Randall is working at Onyx Inc. in Burlington. She joins us now. Lauren, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi.
Hi. Listeners, if you've always had questions about getting a tattoo but didn't know who to ask, feel free to give us a call and speak with Lauren at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Lauren, how or when did you start tattooing?
So I started Onyx in September. I didn't start exactly tattooing until January. They wanted to, like, give me some time to, like, be around the shop. I'm like, no, things work. But my first tattoo was in January, yeah, on one of my best friends.
And still a good friend?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. She's my ride or die.
All right, good. All right. Why was this something that you saw as an exciting career for you?
I didn't really see it as a career at first. I got my first tattoo at 18. Nope, that's a lie. I gave myself my first tattoo at, like, 16. And I went to a shop at 18 and just, like, fell in love with the fact that I could have permanent, like, work on my body that I had drawn. And I was like, that's so cool. Like, I can literally put anything on my body. So, like, that's Francisco, that now I'm like 40 tattoos later.
Wow.
I have a lot of them.
But it's one thing, you know, to do a tattoo on your own body. It's completely different, though, when, you know, you have someone else who now trusts you to tattoo, you know, to do one on them. So what drew you to this, you know, as opposed to maybe other art forms?
I think it was just, like, the permanence of my art being out there. Like, I would give my friends a lot of, like, picture drawings and, like, stuff on paper. And, like, I think at the end of the day, I knew that it wasn't as appreciated. I would, like, be crumpled up in some folder somewhere. So I think, like, the permanence is what drew me to, like, pursue in this, like, type of art form. Because, like, it's always going to be appreciated. It's always going to last forever. And it's an honor to have someone else want my artwork on them forever. It's mm-hmm. kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah. What has it? What is it like? What's the tattoo scene like in Burlington, and what has it been like, you know, now becoming part of it?
I wasn't really aware of it before coming a part of it. I just, like, went to whatever shop I could go to get tattooed. But now that I'm a part of it, it's such a supportive community, and everyone's encouraging everybody to try new things or, like, to expand on, like, their type of style. Instagram has, like, played a big part on, like how I communicate with other people in Burlington, and, like, just, like, small comments, like, oh my gosh, like, that's so good, like, oh my gosh, like, you're killing it, like, it's just those small little comments that it's, the support is really, it's very wild.
I love it.
Like, everyone's very nice, everyone's really, there's no criticism, it's, like, it's artwork, it's really hard to critique someone else's artwork, because right. it's theirs, you know?
Now, tell us about Onyx, Inc., where you're working. It's a women-owned and operated tattoo studio. So tell us all about Onyx, Inc.
Onyx, Inc. is owned by Alicia Dykema. And there's another artist, Nicole Kreisman, who's been here for, I think, she was apprenticed here with Alicia, like, since the beginning, like, when Rick owned it. Then there's Olive, who's a newly added member. And then Haley is our piercer as well. We also have a eyebrow, like a microblading woman that comes every month.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've, like, talked about, like, we're not opposed to hiring a male, but it's just, like, something that we're, like, so known for now. So yeah. I feel like we keep going with it. But it's a great shop to work at. I'm so blessed to be here.
Well, how did you land the apprenticeship at Onyx, Inc.?
So, I was a bartender at Waterworks, and Nadia, my manager at the time, was, like, really good friends with Alicia, and, like, I'd always talk about tattoos at work. I was always, like, getting more tattoos, and I'm artistic myself, and we were at, like, a birthday party one night, and Alicia, like, pulled me over. She was like, hey, like, I'm going to be expanding a new, like, to a new space. Would you be interested in potentially working there? And I was like, yeah, totally, like, that's something I could, like, definitely get behind. Meanwhile, I'm just, like, shaking my boots being like, oh my god, this is actually gonna happen. So yeah, and she had, like, contacted me, I think, like, a month after that, being like, hey, like, can you, like, come to the shop, like, can you, like, kind of talk about contracts and, like, everything I really need to know, like, getting my blood pathogens certificate and all that jazz. So, like, mm-hmm. as soon as that was, like, taken care of, I started painting the walls. I was, like, in the shop every day, like, sweating during summertime. Like, yeah, it kind of fell into my lap, which isn't a very traditional way to get a partnership. Usually you really have to, like, be adamant about going to shops, showing them your portfolio and, like, all this jazz. But I was really grateful to have the connections that I had to make this career happen to myself. Yeah.
Well, you've been there now for the better part of a year. So how has it been?
It's been so amazing. The amount of people that have given me their skin and trusted me to put some work on them has been so amazing. The apprenticeship has flown by. I think I have less than 100 hours left until I'm legally licensed. But it flew by. It really did. It feels like it's been, like, 6 months, not even 12.
Well, Lauren, let's talk about a tattoo apprenticeship. What does that entail, and how long do you need to apprentice before you're licensed?
Yeah, so a typical apprenticeship is 1,000 hours legally, and it's state by state. Like, some states are different. Some states you don't even need a license, but in Vermont you do. That's 1,000 hours, and it's basically just being in the shop and, like, answering phone calls, seeing how the other artists interact with their clients, how professional they're being, and, like, a lot of drawing. Like, I spend, when I wasn't answering phones and, like, just hanging out, I was just, like, drawing, like, getting used to an iPad that I've never drawn an iPad. Like, that's new to me.
Yeah.
Also made my life way easier. I think for a month, I was, like, just drawing straight lines in a book pad, just, like, to kind of get my hand used to it. But, like, now I can draw a straight line, which is great. It's definitely a job that you take home with you as well. This isn't a job that you, like, leave at the office because you don't have enough time in the world to get as much drawing as you actually need to in the shop.
Gotcha. So you mentioned that you started in September. You began tattooing in January. So while apprenticing, how much actual tattooing are you able to do?
Since January, I've been tattooing every day that we work. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. And I try and get at least, like, 3 tattoos in there roughly a day.
Wow.
Depending on, like, all that jazz.
Lauren, when someone comes into Onyx for a tattoo, do they usually have artwork or a design in mind?
Sometimes it varies. I've been getting a lot of, like, people sending me references and, like, kind of picking apart what that is and making it into my own. But then there's also, like, case by case, like, some people come in with, like, an exact idea, and I try my best to not exactly copy it because I don't feel comfortable doing that. But to just, like, kind of create it and make it unique to them.
Yeah, how do you go from a concept they have to the actual tattoo?
I kind of go online and kind of get my own references that kind of go along with that and try and, like, combine them. And, like, it's sometimes if they have, like, specific things that they'd like, it's easier to combine already existing design. Like, say if they wanted, like, a fairy and, like a cow fairy, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So what kind of behind-the-scenes work does it take, you know, for you to have someone who comes in and then be ready to apply a tattoo to their body?
You could start with a consult. That's, like, the best way, especially if you, like, a deeper tattoo or, like, you don't know exactly what you want. You can come in, you can chat about it. I'll sit with them and, like, pull up some reference photos. I'll get some photos of whatever body part they would like so I can kind of work on my iPad with that image. And then we'll set up an appointment, and then they'll come in the day of and look at the design, and we can sit there together and make any adjustments or changes or add anything before it's permanent.
And then, you know, the design you have on your iPad, you know, how do you then have that exact thing done, you know, on my forearm, let's say? Is there, you know, a temporary tattoo you make that you follow, an outline, or how does it go from the iPad to my body?
Yes. So I'll print it off my iPad onto a normal piece of paper, and we just use stencil paper. So it's like this purple Thermomax paper that we put into a machine, and, like, heat will bounce off the black ink on the piece of paper onto the stencil paper. And I'll apply the stencil and then just follow those lines. One day I'll be able to freehand, but not today.
Gotcha. And as you can tell from my questions, Lauren, I am indeed a tattoo virgin. So, you know, but I am trying to understand it for people who, you know, have thought about getting a tattoo, but want to know what would be the steps. What do I have to worry about or think about when I step into Onyx and want to get a tattoo? Has there been more of a demand in the shop since more folks of the state have been vaccinated and are now getting out since either this spring?
Yeah, so before COVID, I know that they were busy, but after COVID, I know it just skyrocketed. Everyone's getting the itch for a tattoo. Sorry, what was the question?
Well, I wondered if, since we've started to get vaccinated and been able to get out, so since like March or April this spring, has demand increased in the shop, which you said it definitely has. During the pandemic, most of last year, what were the protocols at Onyx that you were taking when someone would come in?
So definitely masked up. Everyone had to wear a mask, workers included. We would ask them to come in, come wash their hands, set all their belongings in this, like, little bucket, I would say, like, underneath the little table that we have. They would wipe down their phones in case they wanted to show any references. That's pretty much it, just hand washing, face covering. They would have to leave to eat or drink. Same with the artists. We would go into a separate area to have a beverage or have a little snack and kind of just keep our distance until the actual tattoo, and we actually have to be pretty close to each other to give the tattoo.
Yeah, I would think. and then as far as the time it takes for a tattoo to be done, I'm thinking of there was one that I saw in your portfolio, a snake eating its own tail, which is a nice round, I'm going to say maybe 6 inches in circumference. How long would something like that take?
So that one took, obviously it depends on size too. That one was about a palm size. And I think that one only took like less than 2 hours. So I feel like the drawing aspect takes a little bit longer than actual tattooing, just because it's a little more difficult on paper or pencil to get the same effect as it would on a tattoo. Like the machine just does something different than a pencil kind of would do. So that one only took like 2 hours, like lines and shading all together.
And how much do tattoos cost? If somebody wants to come in and get something maybe that size, what is the fee for a tattoo?
So our shop minimum is 80. So say it's less than an hour, it's going to be $80 flat. Nicole, Alicia, and Olive are at a 150 an hour rate, and I'm going to be starting in August at $100 just to kind of start slow and then build my way up.
Yep. Now, this is my concern, and I'm sure a lot of people's concern who have ever considered a tattoo. How much will it hurt, Lauren?
I personally am such a baby when I get tattooed, but it depends on where you're getting it. Like behind the, like more in like the center areas, that's going to be really sensitive, like bonier areas. It's like a cat scratching a sunburn is what I've been told, and what it kind of feels like to me as well. Mm-hmm. It's like a stinging, vibrating, like cut, but it's nothing too bad.
And when someone has a tattoo, that takes 2 hours, I mean, do you take a break after a little bit, and give them time to kind of regroup and then carry on? Or is it pretty much 2 hours straight?
It kind of varies. I let the person know, like, hey, if you need a break at any point, just please let me know. And, like, I even check in. I'm like, hey, like, how you doing? They're like, oh, great. Like, I'm good. I've had a couple of people need, like, a good 5 minute break to just like grab some water, which is totally fine. Like I'm here as a service to them. I'm not in no rush.
Okay. All right. Now I noticed that Onyx offers some tips if someone's considering a tattoo. You mentioned a consultation up front. But what should someone do in the days leading up to having their tattoo done?
So definitely keep your skin inside and out hydrated. Eat a good breakfast before the appointment. I'd say like an hour before. Come with an open mind. Come with a good attitude. Try not to drink the night before. It kind of makes it worse for everybody. Just know that it's permanent as well. I've had a couple people be like, hey, is this permanent, right? And I was like, yes, this is very permanent. Please know that. It will not go away.
Yeah. And I would, you said don't drink the day before. I would imagine, you know, we talk about getting drunk and get a tattoo, but I would imagine that's something you really guard against.
Yeah, mainly just for the tattoo stick. Like, if you drink, then your skin will, if you drink, then your blood gets a little thin. Excuse me, sorry. And it's just harder for the ink to stay into the skin. That's the only reason, really. Mm-hmm. You can definitely go get a drink afterwards, though. I highly suggest that.
All right. And, yeah, celebrate, because it is something to certainly celebrate. And then let's talk about aftercare after you get a tattoo. What are the important things that one should do with the tattoo once they've gotten it?
Yes. So we highly recommend not a lot of sun exposure after getting a tattoo. You can't swim, unfortunately. That's why summertime is kind of a bummer to get a tattoo in. Keeping it really clean, like if you work out or like go outside or like pet a dog and like get dandruff on you or like you get sweaty, like just keep it clean, keep it out of the sun. After it's healed, after the first 2 weeks, then you can put sunscreen on it to keep it really vibrant and bold. And then we say like just wash it twice a day for that 2 week period.
Right.
But swimming is what really gets it. I swam for my second tattoo and just all fell out. And I had to go back and he was very upset with me.
Lauren Randall works at Onyx Ink in Burlington. You can see the work that the tattoo artists there have created by visiting onyxinkstudio.com. Lauren, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan and produced by Rachel Connor and Zoe Helena and also Brady Jalili. And you can visit our website, wdevradio.com, to listen to the podcast. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.